Hi, I'm John Ackerlin, an alcoholic. And I am very enthusiastic about this program. I'm very grateful for this way of life. It's terrific. I like to thank the committee for the invitation, and for the hospitality, and for the beautiful gift. And I love to be here. This is one place where you have more of an accent than I have, you know. I like to thank Lynn and Monica for picking me up. It's been really terrific. I tell you, it takes me a few moments to get into this thing. They asked me if I was nervous, but I'm really not. But I get very emotional when I think of the implication where you and I would be if it wasn't for this beautiful program, you know. So I have a little hard time to get into my story right away. And I tell you what you should do. Ask Joe Phelan if he will take you on a drive, you know. He is something else. I mean, he is 40 years sober or something, and God drives his car, I tell you. Doesn't matter if he is on the left side or the right side of the road, you know. Everybody else looks a little nervous, but he ain't, you know. I asked him if he would make a U-turn in a tunnel, you know. Well, thanks, Joe. I think this has been something else. Yeah, I couldn't come thirsty because I work once in a while. But I came here Friday, and I just think that Marie, she certainly was so generous with her. And I think the show, it was absolutely outstanding. I just loved every minute of it. I think you guys were fabulous. Thank you so much. And now, Alan and Speaker, this morning, I absolutely your greatest supporter. I have been speaking in Alan and meetings at some of these places, and I always tell them that I am guilty on all accounts, you know. But you had a beautiful, beautiful way of delivering. Now, if I screw up tonight, Bobby Zons will save you in the morning, you know. He's a beautiful guy, and he has one of my favorite friends that I have known for many years, and he has some principles that I really think is outstanding. You know, I have a bunch of friends in this room that I love very much. But most of you have never been seen me before, but in a very short while you will know me very intimately. And that's just one of the neat things that happen in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we can know each other on that level. I have had a great fortune of growing up in a group in Laguna Beach where there were a lot of sobriety. 34, 38, 40, 41, and 42 years of sobriety. And you and I, who are younger on the program, we owe those old-timers a lot. Because when they came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, this was not a sure thing. Maybe. Perhaps it would work. It was an illusion. It was a hope. But thanks to those guys and girls' dedication, you and I have something today. It's a fact and reality that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous work. And you and I, we really owe those old-timers a hand, okay? did I? So far, I've only driven away 3 people. Few people standing back there, and doesn't give a guy too much confidence. It's just like, if I don't like the son of a bitch, I leave, you know. I mean, I don't think I'm too presumptuous if I say that some of us here tonight sit with a bunch of burdens and lots of if onlys. But be that as it may, we are here in these rooms are still the lucky ones, because we have a chance. Lots of people who have this thing called alcoholism doesn't have a chance, and for various reasons. For the record, my grandfather died from alcoholic delirium in 1910. He lived in a 2,000-acre place outside Stockholm, and that's what happened to him. My father had a problem with his liver in 1927, and nobody knew anything about this illness then. He was a giant of a man, he radiated vitality, women adored him and men envied him, but he died 3 years later, and he only weighed 130 pounds when he died, and he didn't want to die at all, and he didn't have much of a chance. I was 8 years old then, and it is something to see a beautiful human being like he once was. Because he was 6'2", and when he touched you, you realized his strength. But in 3 years, he had deteriorated to absolutely nothingness. And I like to make a point when it comes to my father. I hear from time to time from these podiums these days that some of us blame our parents for our own alcoholism. I don't share that opinion. I really became an alcoholic because I drank alcohol myself. It's really that simple. My father was an aristocrat. He was very vain, very proud, very arrogant. But he was also a very loving person. But I was in violence, and that's what I would like to make a point about. You and I are the lucky ones, because we have a program that deals with injustices in both sides of the aisle, theirs and ours. And wouldn't that be rather sad, after we come in here and find this way to live, that we still pin it on somebody else? I know this statement doesn't make some people happy, because some of us like to hang on to that goddamn thing. Love Michael Caine's line, when somebody said to him one time, he said, "Hey, have a nice day." And he said, "No, I have other plans, you know." The point I like is simply this, that thanks to this program, I have been able to forgive my father for the violence. And you know, it is a really important part of it, because it is the foundation of what this program is all about. You know, you and I, every time we finish in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, we finish with the Lord's Prayer, and there is something like, "Forgiven as I forgive those who trespass against us." It wouldn't be sad if we missed out on the basic foundation what this program is built on. Okay? My older brother didn't have much of a chance for another reason. He had a little bit of pride, and it seems to be a commodity that we can't afford the luxury of in this outfit. 20 years ago now or so, he lived in a castle outside Stockholm. He was married to a very beautiful girl. In fact, he married my girlfriend. I had a little bit of problem with that for a while. But now I'm glad he did. But he drank like I drank, and he blew it all. For 18 years, he defended his right to drink. It is something to see this insidious denial some of us have. You know, he made 150 grand a year, spoke 6 languages fluently, carried a Swedish flag in the Olympics on 3 occasions, For 18 years, he lived in a room that cost $15 a month to live in, drank a fifth of whiskey every night, and just lived in the past, and there was nothing ever wrong with him. I tried to 12-step him a few times. His drunk log and mine was very similar. I wrote him a letter one time, page and a half what I used to be like, 3.5 pages about all the wonders that has happened to me since I joined the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a postcard back. Said, "Dear John, I'm sorry to hear about all your problems." I flew to Stockholm in 1978 and spent a couple of weeks with him. I invited him out here, was here for 30 days, and I took him to meetings. He died from yellow yonders 4.5 years ago now. My younger brother is similar. He has gone through Scripps in La Jolla twice. And the doctor there said that you can't drink alcohol anymore. There's something really wrong with your liver. But he doesn't drink the way I did, and that's all he is looking at. He has 7-8 whiskeys before dinner, 2 kinds of wine, coffee and brandy for dessert. It's kind of elegant. He even lights a couple of candles now and then, you know. It looks just like the commercial. It's kind of bullshit, the whole deal, you know what I mean? I retired this little story years ago when I was asked, "Please tell that story about your sister-in-law." Well, anyhow, when he had gone through Scripps that one time, the first time, they came to my home in Laguna, and we sat down and talked about it a little bit, and I said, "Carl," I said, "maybe that church will fix you so you don't have to drink. But if it doesn't work out, maybe you can go with me to a few meetings and see what it's all about." And then she spoke up. And she said, "John, you're an alcoholic, and you know a lot about alcoholism, but you don't know a hell of a lot about anything else." You know? And then I said to her, I said, "You know, I only drank for 10 years. I don't know that much about alcoholism. But I have lived out there in that world sober for more than 16 years. An exciting, beautiful, joyous way of life. So I know a lot about good living. And besides that, it ain't my fucking liver that shot." You know? I really never have been a person who advocate 4-letter words from this podium, but I just didn't want her to misunderstand, you know. If I upset any spiritual giant here tonight, I'd be more than happy to apologize to you, but I just couldn't find a better word for it. We wonder sometimes, what's wrong with my brothers? Nothing. Alcohol did something to my older brother to the day he died. It's still doing something for my younger brother. And that's the nature of the illness. And that's why I said in the beginning that you and I are the lucky ones. Because of the evidences in these rooms that people like you and I, the way we drank and carried on, and we can change and live without it and have fabulous lives. And that's what I think the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is all about, how to live good out there without it. I talk to newcomers. I love newcomers. I like the feelings in these rooms when they're newcomers, and I like being a newcomer myself. It's very important to me. And I like to share with you why I like to be a newcomer. I hope I never forget the last year I drank, because I compromised on everything I believed in or stood for. I couldn't live a function without liquor. I didn't dare to go to sleep if I didn't have a fifth of whiskey in the refrigerator, because I had to have it when I woke up. And if I ran out of booze at midnight, I usually called an associate of mine in Baldwin Park and said, "Harold, next week, you will owe me $150 on this particular job, but if you give me $20 tonight, you won't have to pay me the $130 next week." And I drove a 100-mile round trip at midnight to pick up $20. I didn't dare to buy any booze in Baldwin Park because then I wouldn't make it home. And when I came home to Anaheim, where we lived at the time, I bought a fifth of Imperial Bourbon for $4.85. And then I was safe, and I had to live like that, and I hope I never forget that period in my life. I know some of us, after we get a little well, get a few dollars in our pockets and bedroom privileges again. We forget how it really was. In fact, my wife cut me off 6 months before I came into AA. She really ran out of humor at the end, I tell you. She stood on and looked at me one evening and said, "John, I wish you could find yourself a girlfriend so I wouldn't have to fool with you." She said, "You'd take forever." Now, after sobriety, if you take forever, it's very commendable. I mean, it ain't fair. The other reason why I like to be a newcomer, I'd been going to meetings every day for 90 days. And Phil Petty talked one Sunday morning, and he stood up here and said, "If you keep going to meetings, you will wake up one morning and realize and find out you can function without alcohol. And it is not necessary to drink anymore, and you have a way to go." And I sat down in that room and I said, "I have experienced those feelings." And it was the first time here it dawned on me that I wasn't hooked anymore. That I had some degree of choice over my own actions. And I had already started to experience a freedom here that I hadn't had for a long, long time. And I hope I never forget that period in Alcoholics Anonymous. The knowledge that I wasn't hooked and that I was free, I hope I never take it for granted. I didn't start to drink until I was 31 years old. I know it doesn't sound very promising right now, but that's how it was. But I'd like to share with you how I was when I was young. First of all, the reason why I didn't drink when I was younger. When my father died, I promised my grandmother I was never going to drink, so I didn't drink. When I was 19 years old, I'd gone to college a year. The war broke out. I went in the Air Force for 2.5 years. And after that, I went back to college for 1.5 years, and I was selling at night, and I was trying to help my mom. It was very important to me to play the man of the house. And, you know, I was... That time of my life, you know, I was baffled about everything. My older brother and I tell you, it was something else, you know. He never opened a book. He had A's in everything. I could study to 1 in the morning. I still failed. It really bothered me. In fact, it's still bothering me. You know, I am so sincere. I am willing. I try real hard. I can be good for a short time, and then the bottom falls out. And I couldn't figure out why I was such a screw-up. You know, I had an unbelievable inferiority complex. I'm a perfectionist on top of it, and that's not a good combination. And I contemplated suicide a lot because I knew if I died, I would be my father. And when he lived, I was security and prestige and respect and those things. And I tell you what I did when I was young. I faked it. I pretended I was really together. I was very noisy and opinionated. And that gave me some false courage, and that's how I was when I was young. When I was 31 years old, I was employed by this door factory in Alhambra. My boss was alcoholic, and he taught me how to drink every day, and a new life began for me. You know, I tell you, from day one, I drank a fifth of whiskey a day. For 2 years, I was never drunk, never hungover. I just felt good. And there's something wrong with your system where you can drink that much booze and not be in trouble. You know, I didn't know that. My emotional problems that I had and grew up with, it was like they had never existed. The sky was the limit. I couldn't miss. And you know, I used to come home to my say to my wife, you know, this building business is out of this world. I said, you know. And, you know, a year later, I owned the place. I had sold so many doors, and they couldn't pay me my commission, so they gave me one-third of the stock of the company. And now I was really a success. You know, it's something to come to this country, and a few years later, you have your own business, you know, one way or another. And what I'm going to give you now is the highlight of my drinking career. You know, when you own your place like it was for me, you're a general manager, sales manager, or whatever. And I tell you, I was the truck driver too. I had sold $600,000 worth of doors to a contractor in San Diego, and I was supposed to deliver them in about a few months period. And I worked 7 days, 16, 18 hours a day, and I loved every minute of it. I used to come home to Corona del Mar, which was a little town on the coast down, 3:30 in the morning, and I had a 2.5-ton truck that had 400 door openings on it, and I should deliver them before 8 in the morning in San Diego. And I come home down to the little house we had in Corona del Mar, and carrying had a hot bath ready for me, and I slid in the top down, lit a candle and inhaled, you know, and laid back there, you know. And she came in with a pitcher of martinis and sat down, drank martinis with me. I mean, it's really living. 3:30 in the morning, you lay down in the tub and you smoke that candle and you drink that martini and you spit out the pimento, you know. You know. And then I usually said, you know, I'm just a little immigrant, and I owned the goddamn place. You know? A few years later, they fired me from my own door factory. You know. When I became the owner of the place, there was $60,000 in the hole. I signed a piece of paper and indebted myself $20,000 overnight, and I thought I had a good deal. When I took my inventory in Alcoholics Anonymous, I realized that optimism was one of my defects of character. I have three beautiful girls and a son, and we took them to church on Sundays. We did everything right to be Americans. The only problem with that, the last 4 years I drank, I was a morning drinker. She usually inspected me before we should leave, and many times she just looked at me and said, "Not today." And that hurt my feelings when she took off down the street with the kids in the corner. I had to stand there in the corner at home. So sometimes I ran down the block after her screaming and hollering, you know, and my neighbors were outside talking about the lawn problem, and here I came running by, you know. Sometimes I was strangely clad. She saw me in the rear view mirror coming after her, so she stopped down the block and waited for me and rolled down the window and said, "What's the matter now?" You know. And I said, "Don't forget to pray for me." You know. When I got there, I couldn't hack it. I could take the sermon about 20 minutes max, and then I'd have a drink. 20 minutes into his talk, I just got up and said, "Oh, screw them all," you know what I mean? I went home and I drank Grand Scotch those days and played good music and became very spiritual. Wrote letters to famous people then. King of Sweden had a long letter from me, and Herbert Hoover and Eisenhower and Nixon got one, and Nixon was the only one who answered me. But he lost that time, you know. I have always been a patriot, you know. I played Stan Getz and Dave Brubeck and Labuane, Coleman Hawkins, stuff like that, you know. And seems not like I graduated to Pink Floyd and Brian Ferry and Michael McCann. I don't know what's happening with me here, but it's some kind of a freedom in itself. A couple of years later, it had progressed a little bit. One week she said, let us try the Episcopalian church next Sunday because the congregation certainly doesn't do the job. And I said, sounds terrific. And she said, yeah, they have very colorful costumes there. They sing a lot and you like music, it might hit you. I'd been drinking to five that morning. I still had a shakes when I woke up, so I went out in the kitchen and drank a little codeine cough medicine and two shots of bourbon to stop the shakes and tightened my belt and walked around with small steps and tried to look effective. Passed inspection and came to church. The only thing I can say to you, the routine in the Episcopalian church, it really ain't for drunks. It's a very busy place, you know. I mean, they get up and down and kneel and pray and sit and stand and sing. And I was up and down 3-4 times, then my timing got off, you know. When they sat down, I stood up, you know. In Sweden, when we don't know the words, we sing tra-la-la. I had a couple of solos there all by myself, you know. In fact, the second time I came up there and gave that little deal, there was a guy 5 rows behind me. He said, sit down, you son of a bitch. He said, third time down, I couldn't get up again, you know. I clung to that bench. I tried every trick in the book I knew, get up and couldn't make it. Tried it sideways and backwards and forward. I even tried to roll up. And she sat down and looked at me. She said, for God's sake, Johnny, get up. And I said, it's an absolute impossibility, you know. So they went up and down, and I sat down and sang by myself. And next time I looked behind me, they all done praying. And here's this guy in the row behind me, laying down his knees, his chin in his hand, and he mumbled and looked real serious. And he looked right at me. And I sat down on the floor and stared at him. You know, sometimes you look at the guy, you focus in and you lock and you can't move, you know. And he stared at me and I stared at him and I thought I better look a little casual, so I winked my eye to him. Kind of stopped me for a minute. So we didn't go back to the Episcopalian church. I don't think alcoholics like me or drunks like me really have any problem with booze until we try to stop drinking. And when I started to try to stop drinking, I got into trouble with my liquor. One week she said, you know, you drink too much. I said, what are you talking about? She said, Johnny, you drink way too much booze. I said, well, then I quit. And then I couldn't quit. And that's when it all began. Because when I had been off the sauce for a couple of days, I got the shakes. And then 2 shots of whiskey stopped the shakes. I could function and work. So then I had to con myself into why I had to have a couple of drinks all the time. And then I lied about it, and then I was hiding, and from then on it got worse. When I was into 2-3 years of my drinking, I was up to 2/5 of whiskey a day. The last year I drank, the last 10 months I drank 2 3/5 of whiskey a day, 2 small bottles of codeine cough medicine every day, and 6 anisins 4 times a day, and I was absolutely weird. I couldn't get drunk, I couldn't get sober. The guilt was on all the time and there was no relief. And I just thought I was going crazy. And I probably was. And this period in our lives, or this period in our illness, it's a terrifying thing. You know, you talk about the alcoholic loneliness, and as far as I'm concerned, there is nothing like it. Because it is a total isolation. And we drink to live and we know we are dying. There is no way out of it. And that's how it is. 2 years after the shake began, weirder things happened to me when I stopped drinking. One morning at 4:00, I sat in my bed and looked in front of me, and this big white snake came out of the wall. I never saw anything like in my life. Unbelievable. He came right out of the wall. He was snow white, had 3 black eyes. He was this big in the armor on his fattest part, and he was 23 feet long. It came slowly across the room, stopped right in front of my face and started to hiss at me. This is like this tongue dangling. I could even smell him. kind of a Peralta High Suite, Mozart-y, the whole thing was incredible. And I sat down and said to myself, you know, I haven't had a drink for 3 days, so it can't be the booze, you know. I screamed so loud for fright that my brain exploded for my own sound, and then I fell backwards unconscious. That was my experience with it. The noise in my head for my own screams was so unbelievably loud, it finally just like it exploded, just like poof. And then I blacked out and fell backwards. That was my experience with it. My wife told me in the morning, she said, something strange happened this morning around 4 o'clock. She said, you sat straight up, looked in front of you for a little while, and then you said, one night I made love to her and she wasn't even there. That's kind of tricky. She was actually laying 2 feet away from me there, and she said, what are you doing over there? And I said, I beg your pardon, you know. When she realized what was going on, she started to laugh at me. I started to cry because I felt it was so humiliating to laugh at the guy who was doing his best. In the morning, I had been out in the kitchen. I'd had my codeine cough medicine and my bourbon, and she met me in the hallway. And she said, well, good morning, lover boy. I really didn't feel any pain. I smiled at her. That's the best peace I've had in a long time. Needless to say, I love laughter in Alcoholics Anonymous. To me, that is a spiritual experience. To me, it is very much part of the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anything that you and I have laughed a little bit about tonight was absolutely the deepest tragedy when it happened. And when you and I, in this manner of identification, when it comes to this insanity and this denial, can just laugh about the whole damn mess, it makes it possible for us to forgive ourselves and change. And it is very much part of the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our story, like everybody else's, was sad before I came in here. We started over many times, and every time I had the best of intention, and every time it got worse. You know, one time my wife had a suicide attempt in Palm Springs because she thought I didn't love her anymore. And she said, I just can't live like this any longer. And she drank kind of aspirin herself and locked herself in the bathroom. And I laid on that bed and prayed to God, hoping she would die so she wouldn't have to be with me anymore. Because I knew at that time of my life there was no way out of it for me, because I had really tried. 2 years after that incident, I came into AA. And you can draw your own conclusion how those 2 years were on my guilt connected with it. It was the same year they fired me from my door factory. You've seen my attitude about that. I mean, this is my means of income. And when they said sign off, I just signed off. I said, who needs this head again? Anyhow, now I can just drink and be happy. And that is how it goes. It'll take everything that's near and dear to us before we seem to be willing to throw in the towel and ask for help. The last 4 years I drank, there wasn't anything I didn't try to use to stop sacred things. I had 13 years, 2 hours a day of religious education when I grew up. I swore in the Bible one time in front of my wife, and I swear to God I'm never going to drink again. I said, I never broken my word of honor to you. And she said, at the time, you know, your father never has. And I thought if I used this thing that means so much to me, maybe I can stop or stay stopped. And 2 weeks later, I find myself drunk again. I went to a minister for counseling every week for an hour for 18 months, and I leveled with him. And this gentleman, he said, you know, you have to ask God to help you. I said, Walter, you are a good man. I'm not. You don't talk to your wife the way I talk to mine in the evenings when she corners me about my drinkers or God doesn't want to have anything to do with me. I know I've tried. And this gentleman, he read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he realized in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous that him and I lacked identification. And so he gave up. He even suggested Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what he was talking about. When he wouldn't talk to me anymore, I went to a marriage counselor, a doctor in Santa Ana. I spent $2,000 with this psychologist. There wasn't anything he said to me that my wife didn't tell me for free 3 times a day. There wasn't anything he said to me either that wasn't the truth. Everything he said was the truth. One time he stood down and looked at me and said, you know what's wrong with you? And I said, Doc, why don't you tell me? And he told it all my secrets and all my emotional problems. I said, that's absolutely right, Doc. And that's why I drink. Because I can't stand myself the way I'm put together either. So then he laid on me how I hurt my wife and kids with my deal. So what do? Then you do what I did. I went on the wagon. And the tragedy for us is really this, that the more sober we become, the more we realize how we hurt our loved ones. And that in itself drives us back to drinking again, because that's the only way we know to get out from under the guilt. There's a lot of capable people in the field of alcoholism today, but I sure don't envy them. Because the nature of the illness is still the same today as when I came in. As long as alcohol is doing something for us, it's impossible for anybody talking out of using it. It seems to be the nature of the illness. And that's again why I said in the beginning that you and I are the lucky ones because of the evidence is in these rooms. The last Christmas I drank, I bought a dapper gray Arabian horse. I came home in December sometime and said, you know, if I only had a dapper gray Arabian, I think I could stop drinking, you know. And she looked a little strange, I tell you. And so I bought this beautiful 3.5-year-old dapper gray Arabian horse. I was sober for 1.5 days. And then I had 14 martinis for lunch and fell off the horse too, you know. That was what I had. And I was even a Sunday morning picked up trying to steal a pint of liquor for $3.57 at Trifty Mart. Now you should have seen me that morning. I was drunk and unshaven. I weighed 246 pounds. I couldn't even defend myself. And I just stood on and said, it can't be me. I mean, look where I came from. I was brought up in a beautiful family in the most favorable circumstances. But that morning I looked exactly like a person who has to steal a pint of liquor to live, you know. I had an ultimatum that night that either you get off or else, and I was off. And next day I have an appointment with a big developer. I had a shakes bad, and I went into my little bar to have a couple of shots I could function and see this guy. And 2 drinks didn't do it anymore. I had 8 or more, whatever it was, but I knew I had had too much. And I sat out there in the parking lot that afternoon, and I just wept. I said, God, what has happened to me? What has happened to us? I had the most fabulous plans, you know. Help me or let me die soon. I just can't hack it much longer, you know. And the next day, Karen stood on and looked at me and she said, you know, for years, because of the children, we have stayed together. But now, because of them, we have to part. And either you go down and try that thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, or you have to leave again. And that's how I came in. I just went down out to the La Lona Club in Anaheim because I didn't want to be kicked out again. And there was a lady there that said, do you have a drinking problem? I said, no. I said, I get along as famously with it. Can you do something for my wife? She's crazy. You know, and that's how it is when we come in here. And we don't know it's going to work. And we got to cover our own bases. In fact, if I had known how sick I was when I came in, I would never have stayed. Stopping drinking wouldn't have fixed it. It's a fact. Alcohol was not my problem when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. It had been my solution for so long. You know, and it, absolutely. And we so slowly and so gradually grow into our relationship to liquor, it's impossible for us to see where we are in relationship to liquor and admit it. I think this, that God is so merciful when it comes to this part of our lives. Because I think most of us, if we had known how bad it was, we probably had done away with ourselves instead. You know. And however, there is a line in the big book that says, more will be revealed, and thank God for that line. And the next day it all happened to me. I woke up like I usually did. I went out in the kitchen and drank a little codeine cough medicine and two shots of whiskey and brushed my teeth. I drove down to the Alona Club in Anaheim and finished off a pint of Seagram 7 on the way and stood on bullshit a little bit. And then I went out and had four double martinis for lunch and went back to the club and asked her to call my wife and tell her I was there for the second time already to show her how sincere I was. This guy was standing at the counter there. His name was Charlie Vick, and he became my sponsor. And he just stood on, he said, why don't you come home with me and let us talk? And there was something about this guy, and I said, okay. And we sat in his patio, and he told me his story. And that's what I think is important in Alcoholics Anonymous. One drunk talking to another. And the identification between the two. And when he was true with his story, I realized that he was worse than I was, and he depended more than I did on it, and he was sober. I said, you were that bad and you can stay off the sauce? And he said, yeah. I knew he was telling the truth. But I tried to wiggle out of it one more time. I said, you don't understand, every time I stop drinking, I get the shakes, and weird things happen to me when I stop drinking. And he said, you will only shake for 4 or 5 days. Then you never have to shake again as long as you live. And I didn't know that. I sat on and said, what information this guy is coming up with here, you know. And you know, another beautiful thing about this is, I sat down, I looked at him, and I said, what's in there for him? There's no money. And you know, this thing is really the most fabulous thing there is, you know, as far as an alcoholic is concerned. One drunk talking to another alcoholic. This thing with no money. And I love about no publicity and no recognition. I just love an understanding. You know, it's a potent thing that you and I have to help somebody else. You know. And he told me that afternoon about the disease of alcoholism. He called it an analogy of the body coupled with the obsession of the mind. And he said, the first drink is a mental one to make you comfortable. And then the body takes over and craves more booze, and you cannot control your drinking pattern or your behavior pattern. You know, it's the only thing we hear is truth. That's right. Absolutely how it was for me all the time. That evening I was in a meeting, and when they read portion of chapter 5 that Monica read so beautiful for us tonight, I just said, please God help me today to stay sober. And it wasn't a big deal. You know, I always thought the spiritual experience would be something like, kaboom, yes, John, what can I do for you? You know. But it wasn't like that at all. It was merely a feeling. And my thoughts were these, that perhaps after all this dies away for me too. When I came home tonight, I said to Karen, I said, you know, it happened to me tonight. I don't have to drink anymore. And she said, your eyes look different. I haven't had to drink alcohol, any codeine cough medicine, or strange pills or funny cigarettes since that day. And it's 27 years and 9 months and 21 days ago today. And you all knew, you might sit down and say to yourself, well, it must be easy for you to have all that time on the program. But it wasn't easy then, and that's what we are dealing with right now. You know, I was not a great success when I came in here. I had a lot of anxieties about my kids. I wanted to be a good father. I knew I wasn't most of the time. I was $36,000 in the hole, and they were all small bills and all due. And carrying suicide attempts, that just about drove me crazy. It's very hard to live with yourself when you realize that you're broken and not a human being spirit. But I didn't drink and I went to meetings. And that's all I had going for me for quite a while. But I'd like to tell you who I knew. Those first 2 months of my sobriety, I had the most unbelievable fears. I couldn't handle nothing. When the phone rang at home, I just pointed it. I said, and I split and hid in my closet. You know, I looked good. I had a 3-piece Brooks Brothers suit on, you know, but I just I sat on the floor and wept. I had 10 days of sobriety. I sat in the front row and blurted out, "You guys don't understand, but I feel so goddamn guilty." And that was an old timer that said, "The reason you feel so guilty is because you're guilty." And there were guys like that that saved my life, and for the first time I could admit that it was my fault without reservations. You know, as long as we pin it on somebody else or something, nothing can happen to us. But I just came to the conclusion, whatever they had done or she had done or said, I drove them to it. And when I took it on that basis, I was free. But when that meeting closed that night, it was probably the most crucial time for me here, because I felt trapped. I felt I was in a corner I couldn't get out of. I actually regretted that I had copped out and admitted it was my fault. The only thing I had going for me here then was this, that I knew under no circumstances could I go back to drinking again. No matter what, I couldn't escape to booze anymore. I had done enough damage. I had no more rights when it came to liquor, and whatever was coming my way, I just had to plain face the music, but I couldn't split with booze anymore. So I'd actually taken the first 2 steps in this program and didn't know it. But how do you turn your will and life over to the care of God as you understand Him? What's your spiritual experience in these rooms? That happened to me moments later the same evening. As I stood all alone and afraid, this guy came up to me. I never saw him before. And he just put his arm around me and said, "Johnny, don't worry, everything is going to be all right." And I believed him. As I began for me with a higher power, it was just like those guys had my welfare taught, and I just trusted them. Those guys for quite a while gave me the courage to face my wrongs and my difficulties. And they talked to me in a fashion I'd never experienced before, because they didn't point fingers and there was no judgment. They just shared their own experiences from heart to heart. And this love and this care that goes on in these rooms is really the most healing commodity that we can offer or being offered. It suits us back to good health, and it gives us a God of our very own that we can trust under any condition. It's here for everybody. Nobody is excluded. In fact, I can't for a moment believe that God would let us go through all these things and then bring us in here and show us this way to live if He didn't have plans for us. It really wouldn't make any sense at all. And then, you know, my sponsor said that I had to put sobriety number one in my life. It had to become before anything else. And Chuck C. used to say that it had to be the number one on the totem pole. I said, "No, my kids comes first. I love them all my life." I said, "Johnny, without sobriety, you won't have them, and you have a letter in your pocket to prove it." And that was true. So I said, "Well, my business, I got to pay them bills." He said, "Johnny, you drank up a door factory or 36 grand in the hole. If you don't stay sober, you're going to blow this deal too." And everything I came up to, he plugged. And I realized, yeah, that's true. Without sobriety, I have nothing. And then, you know, something really remarkable happens now. You see, and this was my experience. When we have no conditions in our sobriety, it's a different ball game. You know, my wife, for example, didn't believe that I was going to stay sober. It took 2 years sobriety before she realized I meant business. And, you know, she intimidated me a lot in the beginning. But that's really no big deal, because you and I got something, you know. When it comes to trust, it's nothing we can demand. It is something we have to earn, you know. And that's what the day at a time is all about. But you know, you and I, we have something going on here that the family don't realize at home. They are just suspicious, how long is this going to last, you know. But you know, we get a lot of strokes here. You're doing just fine. Just come to meeting. Don't worry about it. It's going to be all right. And you know, we get all these strokes here. And you know that I don't care what a terrible day I had one day. And I laid out night. And she'd go to bed, and I said, oh, what a goddamn day I've had. But I didn't drink. And you know, then I lay down, and I thought, my God, I used to get drunk of a lot less. And then this starts to baffle us, where I say, my God, this thing is mine. This is my own. This thing called sobriety. It's the only decent thing that has happened to me in years. This must be some sort of a gift. You know, then there is something unbelievable happening to us, because there will be start to become a consistency in our living. And you know, we have something going for ourselves. And then we add to it. And it takes a little while. But you know, as long as we remember that thing, and that's the miracle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that you do and I do not have to take the first drink anymore. In fact, it became so serious with me that my business and my only business was to stay away from the first drink. That was my only business. All the rest was God's business, good and bad. And when even the bad is part of God's business, then it becomes like I realize that this is just a period within a period. It ain't going to be this bad forever. And then we start to get a little trust and faith in the whole deal. And you know, and we can go through quite a bit in that. And then other things happen to us. One time she said, before you had a booze as a crutch, now you have those damn meetings. Are you that kind of a weakling, you can't stand on your own 2 feet? I said, yeah, I am that kind of a weakling. And she said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to a meeting because I don't want to get drunk. And that was the time when she realized that I was not on the wagon. Something had happened to me. And then she joined the program of Al-Anon, and it has been a fabulous love affair ever since. See, you and I are strong when we can admit weakness. That's our strength and survival here. We don't have to prove nothing anymore, because this is bigger than all of us. That's why we have the ABCs in chapter 5. It says, God could and would if he was sought. I envy you who knew what you're going to find out about yourself, providing you go to meetings. I plain envy you what you're going to find out about yourself. And you don't believe me now, and I didn't believe it then, but it was actually the greatest opportunity I ever had in my life when I was beaten down to nothing, so don't fret it. We have all been there. You sit on an opportunity if you're throwing the towel that has to love you and help you. It's a trip and a half here. Long ago now, she said, you know, it wasn't always your fault. Long ago now, she said, you know, this life we live today is really the most fabulous adventure. It was so hopeless and tragic at one time, completely turned around. There's even a degree of innocence between us today. And that's almost impossible to believe, but that has come to pass because she's just as busy now as I'm in AA. We have seen so many people over the years have turned around and started to be good to one another. Nothing is in vain. All that bad stuff is going to benefit some others. And it'll all make sense later on, you know. You know what I... The inventory I was... I thought, my Charlie said, you got to take the inventory. I had such a poor feeling about the whole. I think it won't make a damn bit of difference if I take that inventory. He said, well, if you don't take your inventory, you ain't going to stay sober. I thought, God, I'm going to prove to him it won't make a bit of difference. So then I took it. And then I told Charlie. And the funny thing after that, it was just like I had fulfilled a contract for sobriety. I didn't have to worry anymore about getting drunk. And another thing happened in that inventory. I realized there was a repetition in my life, throughout my life in the same areas. I realized these were my defects or pecs and shortcomings. And I realized that I could not do anything about them on my own. That is something that I had to give to my higher power, and he would remove them on his time and his terms. That was God's business. You know. And then I realized another thing that was really important. I realized that Karen had some problems, some obsessions in her life. And when you and I have our obsessions, and then we get this empathy for somebody else that have obsessions. And I realized that if I should use common sense or logic to straighten her out, I was actually going to make her sicker instead of better, because she had to defend it even more so. So when she was in that period in our thing, I just didn't react to it. I just turned my cheek. And when I didn't react to her fears and desires, got less and less. And then she got help from her Al-Anon sponsor. And then no two people surrender at the same time. You know, and you know, this is the marvelous thing that, you know, you and I, we take care of our deal, and they take care of theirs. And it's on God's timetable. It's a very spiritual thing. Because I know in the beginning, my first 3 years, I was very self-righteous. But that left little by little. I'm almost perfect now, you know what I mean? If you haven't taken your inventory, I'll give you a little help. They have a long form and short form. First, write down the four things you have decided not to tell anybody, even under severe torture. It will save you 62 pages of writing, you know. The first year I went to 7 meetings a week. From then on I went to 5 meetings a week. Seems to be a lot of meetings. I go up 6:30, 6:45 every morning. I work very hard. It's a privilege as far as I'm concerned. Any of you knew me, I said, well, God, what schedule. All this thing in Alcoholics Anonymous and all that's going on there, and then all this thing I'm doing in business. I tell you, I live more normal than normal people do. The only difference, I'm aware of it. Something else. You know, the last 4 years I drank, like I said, 7 days a week, 16, 18 hours a day to deliver something so I could invoice something, so I could collect something, so I got enough money in that I could drink enough booze and codeine to carry me one day. It's a full-time job to stay drunk, you know. When I came in here, my two oldest girls were 13 and 10. With my schedule as it is, I played tennis with them twice a week for 10 years while they grew up. It's important to be part of their lives. I taught them how to ride that horse I fell off, and they had him for 10 years. I relieved my youth with those two kids. My two young ones can't even remember me drunk or drinking. Ain't that something? They were that little. I've experienced everything with them that I wish my father could have experienced with me, and it is just like I have sensed his presence here all along in this journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. There is no emptiness any place in my life anymore. It has just, it's just a different communication. Katrina had the same personality as I have. Desperate need for approval, never feeling she was enough, and contemplated suicide since she was 14. I'd like to tell you the 28th of this month. She has 6 years. She's beautiful and free. She has a spirit like Karen had when I met her when she was 17. The same deal. It's beautiful. My son was hooked on drugs and pot for 4 years when he went through Laguna Beach High School. First of May this year, 11 years without pot and drugs, you know. And he is. And it is hard on us parents when it comes to the kids. But I never had to give them ultimatums that involved total ejection. You know, their thing, what they had, was a lot more serious than my little vanity. And I tell you, it was a big deal for me when I was right and didn't have to say nothing. It's even a bigger deal when I could give everybody else the right to be wrong, and I didn't have to interfere in God's timetable. It's a beautiful thing what you taught me here. Now about resentments. It's our number one killer. And you know, my older brother was the one that I had the worst time with about resentments, because I could never understand him and me. He hated me with a passion. He was only a year and 9 months older than I was, but when he was 12 years old, he was 6'4", weighed over 200 pounds. And I was just little compared to him. And he used to punch me out, and I rolled over under a dining room table, and I pretended I had fainted so he wouldn't hit me anymore. And I tell you, I was so ashamed of not going up and slugging it out with him, but I was no match for him. And I didn't feel much like a man. When I was 13 years old, he drowned me. He was a water polo player in the Olympics, Swedish team. He was in the gymnastics and carried a Swedish flag. And he was some athlete. We were out there, and it was 15 feet depth, and he just held me under till I heard my father's voice talking to me from the other side. And it's a terrifying thing to drown. When I came through, he had dragged me up, and I lay down and coughed out water, and I thought, why does he hate me so much? I just want him to tolerate me. And here I am in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm supposed to forgive him. I said, am I some sort of a second-class citizen just because I've joined Alcoholics Anonymous? And I got to be something more to it than this. I said, yeah, I'm going to say, oh, I forgive you and I love you. What bullshit is this? You know, I mean, it's so hypocrite. I didn't feel it at all. And then I said, give me some guidelines, you know. I tried praying. It was nonsense. But then one guy said, try to understand your resentment. But for one reason or another, I turned around. I said, why did he resent me? And that was another ball game. You know, it just came like a film. The whole thing between him and me, I realized at that instant that our father favored me when we were little. You know, but when I was 3 years old, my father used to lift me up and hug me and kiss me. And he was an obese baby, you know. He was not the lap baby, you know. And I could see his eyes. What about me? And I realized he is such an introvert and so serious. He needed more love than I did, and I was in the way. And then I thought, how can I set this straight? That he doesn't have any problem with me anymore about all this thing. And I thought, I got to communicate. And I tell you, next day I had a letter from him. I hadn't heard from him for 15 years. And what do you think? This is a coincidence. He rattled up. He's over 40 years old, and he rattled up at how he had taken gymnastics in junior high school, became one of the best athletes in my country. He was an officer and a gentleman. He lived out in the castle out of Stockholm, just like my father grew up. And he did all these things and had all this ambition to just glorify our father's name, you know. And do you remember when we were 12 and we talked about it? Our father, what a great man he was, da 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 da. And I said, here's a guy, he has lived his life. The purpose of him living is to get the approval from our father, and he can't get it because he died when he was 9. And I just wrote this little note. I said, dear Bethel, if our father would have been alive today, he would have taken you in his arms and said, you have succeeded beyond my greatest expectations. Your loving brother, John. I haven't had any resentment since. But you know what the payoff is? I lost my inferiority complex. It's an amazing thing what happens to us when we surrender this ego and self in through these steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If anything at all happens to us, we little longevity on the program it is. We get a little more of understanding for other human beings. It's a beautiful thing. I know we shouldn't go overtime in Alcoholics Anonymous. It drives these old timers crazy, you know what I mean? I have a friend in Glendale, his name is Bob Lemkin, he's a full-blooded German, and I had a little problem with the Germans during the war, you know what I mean? I knew him for 4 years and I realized I loved him. He's a great AA and he does a lot of 12-step work, you know, and a great AA. And I, for the last 16 years, Bob has invited me for his birthday to speak on his birthday. He had 26 years the last year when I was up there. But you know, he is one of those old timers who don't save any souls after 10 buddy, that type, you know. He even talks funny, you know. You know, he was actually born in this country, has more of an accent than I have. I can't figure out, he must practice every night or something, you know. But here it was, you know, and mind you, he invites me there. 10 o'clock, I had a minute and a half to wrap up my story, and he sits back down and shouts, John, for God's sake, it's 10. I said, Lemke, this is only an AA meeting. We ain't marching into Poland tonight, you know. You realize I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The 12 steps, that's the recovery program. I love in the beginning of the book where it says alcohol is a mere symptom of something deeper-seated emotional. I love in the beginning where it says God as we understand him, you know. Think about it. This program doesn't interfere in anybody's religion. I mean, it must be something comprehensive, something deeply spiritual, when it doesn't interfere in anybody's religion. It's a beautiful thing. I love in the beginning of the book which says we are 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. What a beautiful promise that is. But the fellowship, these rooms where we have our meetings, they have a great importance because it takes a little while before everything falls in place with those steps in our lives. I'll share this little episode and then I'm sitting down. Was another guy, his name was Bill Schellenberger, he was also a German, and he got sober in Anaheim. The first 2-3 years, when I 12-stepped a German, I wasn't very nice. I usually said, don't rush into this thing, it's so good out there, you know. I just wanted them to suffer a little longer, you know. But Bill and I became the dearest friends, you know, and he had 9 years of sobriety. He was a framing contractor. And there was a gentleman developed out my way those days. His name was Albert Wilson. He built about 1,000 homes a year. And he was over 70 years old, but he was a beautiful man. And Bill was framing 110 houses for Mr. Wilson in Mission Viejo, and it was in July, and it was 84 degrees hot. And I came out there Friday afternoon to see what my guys were doing. And I come out down the street on the job site, and Billy's up on the second floor nailing on the roof rafters, you know. And he was a good-looking guy, 6'2", you know, and red handkerchief around his forehead, and no T-shirt, and shorts on, a big belt, a big hammer, 30-foot tape and construction boots, you know. And he looked macho, you know, and he's up there swinging that hammer there, you know. And so I come down the street there. Just then Mr. Wilson and six vice president coming down the cul-de-sac, but Bill saw me, and he screamed, "John!" And he leaped from that roof right down in the dirt, down dust, and the smoke is flying, and he threw himself around me and kissed me twice, you know. I mean, here we are, two big guys in a construction job. Wow, Jesus Christ, you know, like, God damn it. You know, and we all standing there hugging each other, you know. And Mr. Wilson is standing there looking at us, you know. And he said, "What's going on with you guys?" And Bill said, "Oh, Mr. Wilson, old John and I went through Alcatraz together." He said. But he knew better. He stood there, he was really serious. He had tears in his eyes. He said, "No, I don't think so. But whatever it is, it's beautiful." And that's the fellowship. That's these rooms. This one drunk talking to another. Chuck Chamberlain, when he lived amongst us all those years, he was trying to show us what's going on in these rooms. It's called love with no conditions. Love with no conditions. You and I can be who we are and what we are, and in spite of it, we are loved. There is nothing like it on the face of this earth. And then due to the fact that this ism that you and I have, we belong. We belong to each other. There is a sense of belonging in these rooms that is haunting. It's a fact and reality that alone we cannot do it, but together we can. And that's this fellowship. They will carry us when we can't care for ourselves. It's a beautiful thing. I like to finish with that when I was 13 years old, I used to sit and look out over the ocean in Sweden. And I had intentions and anticipations and dreams. I'm 68 years old now. I look out over the ocean in Laguna Beach every day. I have intentions and anticipations and dreams. And I'm extremely vulnerable. And I thank God every day for that sensitiveness that you and I have, that we used to curse. We say, "Why am I so different? Why do I overfeel in all directions? What's the matter with me?" They call it emotional immaturity. They have all kinds of labels to it. You know, that sensitiveness that you and I have, when we practice the principle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it will be a blessing, because it becomes like a thermostat. And it motivates us to take the action that is laid out in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The action we take sets us free. Chuck used to say, "You can't think yourself into good living. You have to live yourself into good thinking." It's the action we take that sets us free. And then, you know, we wonder sometimes, how can I have a change of attitude? I don't care what spiritual heights anybody living under. Two things bothers all of us. It's either what we do or what we don't do. It's asinine. It's that simple. But you know, if it is something that I do, I have to stop it. If it is something I don't do, they call it procrastination. I have to attend to it, otherwise I'm going to magnify that out of proportion. It's really, if we live by those rules, you know, we can't, you and I, the longer we are sober, the more sensitive we become. I can't live with secrets. This is the only place where I can totally expose my innermost self to you, and you love me in spite of it. Then sometimes you and I have some fears. Chuck used to say it has something to do with the distance from God we are. But he had a more profound line than that. He said, it's a conscious separation from God. Conscious implies that I have something to do about it. There again, I'm my deal. And when I take the action, I'm free. I like to say to you guys who are, and ladies who are new, just do this. Don't drink and use. Go to meetings. It's the best deal in town. Thank you very much.